Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's Greatest Briton is Rudyard Kipling, the celebrated poet of the British Empire. And this will be in two episodes. And of course, my co-host for the show is Max Musson from Western Spring. Well, shall we have a look at our Greatest Briton for today then?
Yes, let's do that.
We've got a new Greatest Briton for today. I believe it's our first author. Rudyard Kipling is our Greatest Briton for today. And I always thought his name was Rudyard Kipling, but apparently it's Rudyard. It's actually named after a place in Britain. Joseph Rudyard Kipling was born 30th of December 1865 in India and was an English journalist, short story writer, poet and novelist. Much of his work was inspired by the country of his birth. Kipling's works of fiction include books such as The Jungle Book, Kim and many short stories, including The Man Who Would Be King in 1888. His poems include Mandalay, Gunga Din, The Gods of the Copybook Headings, The White Man's Burden, and If. He is seen as an innovator in the art of the short story, and his children's books are classics, with one critic noting that he had a versatile and luminous narrative gift. I'll just stop there because I can remember being a child and being told that if I could memorise the whole of the poem If, that I would be given my first watch. And I'm sure lots of young boys are taught to memorize that poem, If. It's just one of a kind, telling people what it means to be a man. He was such a famous poet. Do you have any comments that you'd like to say about the poem If, Max?
Well, I never learnt it off by heart in the way that you suggested, so please don't put me on the spot and ask me to quote passages out of it. But yes, I think that you're quite right that it is a poem to a younger man, explaining to him the qualities that he needs to have in order to be a true man, effectively. And so I think from that perspective, it's a poem that is instructive as far as children are concerned. But it's one that you can read to children and that they can understand. And I think as far as Kipling's other works are concerned, that particularly the ones that are aimed at children, obviously that they have a quality that children find engaging, and that that's the reason really for their success. And I think probably the most famous of his stories is going to be The Jungle Book, and it's also become the most famous Disney film as well, with the Disney Jungle Book. And I think a lot of children imagine, what their life would be like if they were ever left in the jungle or some other hostile environment, and what it would be like perhaps to be adopted and brought up by wolves. And so it's something which is great fiction, but at the same time really, really engages with young children's minds.
I think it must have had an influence on Baden-Powell as well. I seem to remember that the names from the Jungle Book are actually used in Cub Scouts somewhere for the leaders of the Cub Scouts, because I mean he was around at the same time as Rudyard Kipling. And I'm sure we'll probably have a look at the poem If, and also the White Man's Burden at some point in this series. Well, Kipling, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, was among the United Kingdom's most popular writers, with American author of the time, Henry James, saying of him, "Kipling strikes me personally as the most complete man of genius, as distinct from fine intelligence that I have ever known." In 1907, he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature as the first English language writer to receive the prize, and at 41, the youngest recipient all the way until today. He was also sounded out for the British Poet Laureateship and several times for a knighthood, but he declined them both. Following his death in 1936, his ashes were interred at Poets' Corner, a part of the south transept of Westminster Abbey. Kipling's subsequent reputation has changed with the political and social climate of the age, looked on as a creative genius in the age of empire and a white supremacist by liberals today. Literary critic Douglas Kerr writes in 2002, "Kipling is still an author who can inspire passionate disagreement, and his place in literary and cultural history is far from settled. But as the age of the European empires recedes, he is recognised as an incomparable, if controversial, interpreter of how empire was experienced. That and an increasing recognition of his extraordinary narrative gifts make him a force to be reckoned with." And he's really talking about a time that we look back to very fondly, I think, when we had the British Empire and the Anglo-Indians that were actually out there in India. They were living a life of the upper classes with servants, and perhaps in ways that they wouldn't have been able to afford to do when they were actually in Britain. And people that are still out there today have servants in these countries, and they were really sort of living a lifestyle, an idyllic lifestyle, I think, really, and also trying to set a good example for these people. And Kipling really associated himself with India, as we will see. I mean, he was white, he was of British stock, but his love was really for India. And as we know, India was originally settled by white people thousands of years ago with the Aryan invasion. So there is obviously a link there between white people and India in particular. And I think this accusation of white supremacist, part of that may come about because of the poem The White Man's Burden. And also in all his books, he used to have a swastika, interestingly enough, because this was at a time when the swastika was seen as a positive symbol and a symbol of European culture. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
Well, I've got a copy of Kipling's Just Say Stories, which was printed around about 1935, and it's got an emblem on the front, which is an elephant eating what looks like some sort of a lotus flower or something. But also in the to one side of the emblem is a swastika, and there's also a swastika on the spine of the book, and that was produced at a time not because Rudyard Kipling was a white supremacist, but because Rudyard Kipling wanted to wish his readers good luck, and the swastika was an emblem of good luck in those days.
Well, Rudyard Kipling was born on the 30th of December 1865 in Bombay, in the Bombay Presidency of British India, to Alice Kipling, née MacDonald, and John Lockwood Kipling. Alice was one of the four MacDonald sisters who were all married to notable men. She was a vivacious woman of whom Lord Dufferin would say, "Dullness and Mrs. Kipling cannot exist in the same room." John Lockwood Kipling, a sculptor and pottery designer, was the principal and professor of architectural sculpture at the newly founded Sir Jamsetji Jeejeeboy School of Art in Bombay. John and Alice had met in 1863 and courted at Rudyard Lake in Rudyard, Staffordshire, England, and they married and moved to India in 1865, where they remembered the beauty of the Rudyard Lake area so fondly that they named their first child after it. Kipling's most prominent relative was his first cousin, Stanley Baldwin, who was Conservative Prime Minister three times in the 1920s and the 1930s. Kipling would later write of Bombay, "Mother of cities to me, for I was born in her gate, between the palms and the sea, where the world-end steamers wait." According to Bernice M. Murphy, Kipling's parents considered themselves Anglo-Indians, a term used in the 19th century for people of British origin living in India. And so too would their son, though he spent the bulk of his life elsewhere, and complex issues of identity and national allegiance would become prominent in his fiction. Kipling often referred to such conflicts. For example, "In the afternoon heats before we took our sleep, she, the Portuguese ayah or nanny, or Mita, the Hindu bearer or male attendant, would tell us stories and Indian nursery songs, all unforgotten, and we were sent into the dining room after we had dressed with the caution, 'Speak English now to Papa and Mama.' So one spoke English, haltingly translated out of the vernacular idiom that one thought and dreamed in." And it is bizarre that Kipling is looked at as more summing up the spirit of India and being able to more correctly describe India and being representative of India than Indians themselves. And that it is because he obviously spoke Indian, and he was brought up by these Indian servants and taught to think in the way that they thought, as well as being brought up to be English. And as we'll see, he was at school in Britain. So he really understood what life was like over there and what life was like over here. But he wasn't mixed race or anything like that. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
Well, it's quite a common feature of people that have lived in what were the old colonies, and that, South Africa, for example, a very similar experience was had by whites living in South Africa, in that they would tend to have servants who were perhaps native or who were migrants from other parts of the empire. That they grew, they would grow up in a country which wasn't their the country of their ethnic origin, but it was the country in which they were born, and so they would form an attachment to that, and very often there is a really, really strong attachment to the land and the beauty of the country. Because if you look at Africa and you look at India, and I mean every part of the world effectively has got some aspect of beauty to it, and if you're born in a place and you grow up there, then you will always have a special attachment to that place as a result, in my view.
They also form quite an attachment to their servants. I mean, people still have servants today out in places in Asia, and it's not like these people are badly treated. They look after them. I know people that lived out in Asia, and they still write to their servants that they had while they were living out in Asia. And I should imagine he formed quite a deep attachment with the nanny. Well, what does it say here? The nanny and the Hindu bearer or male attendant that he had. I'm sure he had quite an attachment to these people that were really like stand-in parents to him, I guess. Well, Kipling's days of strong light and darkness in Bombay ended when he was 5, as was the custom in British India, when he and his 3-year-old sister Alice, Trix, were taken to the United Kingdom to Southsea Portsmouth to live with a couple who boarded the children of British nationals living abroad. For the next 6 years, from October 71 to April 77, the children lived with this couple, Captain Prize Agar Holloway, once an officer in the Merchant Navy, and Sarah Holloway, at their house in Southsea. In his autobiography, published 65 years later, Kipling recalled the stay with horror, and wondered if the combination of cruelty and neglect which he experienced there at the hands of Mrs. Holloway might not have hastened the onset of his literary life. If you cross-examine a child of 7 or 8 on his day's doings, especially when he wants to go to sleep, he will contradict himself very satisfactorily. If each contradiction be set down as a lie and retailed at breakfast, life is not easy. I have known a certain amount of bullying, but this was calculated torture, religious as well as scientific. Yet it made me give attention to the lies I soon found it necessary to tell. And this, I presume, is the foundation of literary effort. And I'll just stop there, because the schooling for these people that would go out into the British Empire was very, very strict, and they were very disciplined, and they were taught to have a sense of oneness with the people around them, a sense of being responsible for the people around them, as because they would be looked up to, they would be leaders, and they would end up being responsible for these people. That the higher up the upper classes you were, the stricter the schooling actually was, so that they didn't end up becoming spoilt brats. So I should imagine he was probably caned at this school, and he was told that he needed to get his story straight, basically. So this would have been the best way to do it. Ask him what had been going on while he was tired and going to bed, and then in the morning when he had woken up, question him on it. And this would have sharpened his mind. This would have made him really made him into the man that he ended up being. So he had 6 years there at this school. And in the spring of 1877, Alice returned from India and removed the children from there, taking them to his aunt's house. And Kipling remembered, often and often afterwards, my beloved aunt would ask me why I had never told anyone how I was being treated. Children tell little more than animals, for what comes to them they accept as eternally established. Also, badly treated children have a clear notion of what they are likely to get if they betray the secrets of a prison house before they are clear of it. And he's a very wise man, I think, Rudyard Kipling. Alice took the children during spring 1877 to Golding's farm at Loughton, where a carefree summer and autumn was spent on the farm and adjoining forest, some of the time with Stanley Baldwin, the future Prime Minister. In January 1878, he was admitted to the United Services College at Westward Ho, Devon, a school recently founded to prepare boys for the army. It proved rough going for him at first, but later led to firm friendships and provided the setting for his schoolboy stories, Storky and Co. While there, Kipling met and fell in love with Florence Garrard, who was boarding with his sister Trix at Southsea, to which Trix had returned. Florence became the model for Maisie in Kipling's first novel, The Light That Failed, in 1891. So his sister obviously didn't find the schooling too bad. She actually went back to Southsea, while Kipling went on to Westward Ho in Devon. Have you got any comments on any of that, Max?
Well, I kind of gleaned from what you were saying there about Kipling's education, that he perhaps felt that the education was unnecessarily cruel. And so although that may have been intended to sort of toughen him up and make him more mentally alert, I think that the fact that his mother came and took him away from that would perhaps tend to suggest that the parents weren't as aware of quite how cruel the education was. A lot of people that served in the Empire would have sent their children back to England, either to public schools or to be schooled in public school system here in the UK, so that they would have an English or a British education, because that sort of an education wouldn't exist out in the colonial parts of the world. And then once they were through that, it was quite common for boys to make a career in the forces, and that they would then, upon leaving school, go into some form of military training, and then perhaps be posted back out to India or Africa as a soldier, or perhaps an officer to continue the administration of the empire. That was the system that existed, and it seems as though Kipling was all part of that. And despite the fact that he had a certain amount of cruelty attached to his early education here in the UK, it would appear that he had some good times as well, and that obviously would have set him in good stead, and would have given him a more rounded impression of Britain relative to the Empire, and the Empire relative to Britain before his return back to India.
Yeah, it's interesting that he went to this school that prepared people for the army, but he ended up with a literary career as well. Near the end of his schooling, it was decided that Kipling did not have the academic ability to get into Oxford University on a scholarship, and his parents lacked the wherewithal to finance him. And so Kipling's father obtained a job for him in Lahore, India, where the father was serving as principal of the Mayo College of Art and curator of the Lahore Museum. Kipling was to be the assistant editor of a local newspaper, the Civil and Military Gazette. He sailed for India on the 20th of September 1882, and arrived in Bombay on the 18th of October, describing the moment years later. So, at 16 years and 9 months, but looking 4 or 5 years older, and adorned with real whiskers, which the scandalised mother abolished within 1 hour of beholding, I found myself at Bombay, where I was born, moving among sights and smells that made me deliver in the vernacular sentences whose meaning I knew not. Other Indian-born boys have told me how the same thing happened to them. This arrival changed Kipling. As he explains, there were yet 3 or 4 days' rail to Lahore, where my people lived. After these, my English years fell away, nor ever, I think, came back in full strength. So that's strange. I mean, he found himself just using words and remembering words and sentences that he just started speaking, but didn't actually know what the meaning of it was, where he had been taught these words and taught to think in this way back before he was taken off to Britain, before he was 6 years old. Do you want to mention anything about him travelling off to India?
Well, I was just going to say that the passage a bit earlier on where we were talking about the servants ushering the children in to see their parents in the evening and they're being told to speak in English to their parents and not in the local vernacular. And so that would tend to suggest that to some extent Indian was, the local Indian language would have been competing with English as Kipling's first language. And so his first language could perhaps have been considered to have been some form of Indian, local Indian language, but that his education and particularly the fact that he spent some years living here in England, that displaced the vernacular and left him speaking English with little understanding of the Indian phrases and words that he'd learned in his small childhood.
It's amazing what you can remember from being a child. Well, Kipling worked in British India for local newspapers such as the Civil and Military Gazette in Lahore and the Pioneer in Allahabad until 1889. The former, which was the newspaper Kipling was to call his mistress and most true love, appeared 6 days a week throughout the year, except for one day breaks at Christmas and Easter. Stephen Wheeler, the editor, worked Kipling hard, but Kipling's need to write was unstoppable, and in 1886 he published his first collection of verse, Departmental Ditties. That year also brought a change of editors at the newspaper, with Kay Robinson, the new editor, allowing him more creative freedom, and Kipling was asked to contribute short stories to the newspaper. In an article printed in the Chum's Boys Annual, an ex-colleague of Kipling stated that he never knew such a fellow for ink. He simply revelled in it, filling up his pen viciously and then throwing the contents all over the office so that it was almost dangerous to approach him. The anecdote continues. In the hot weather, when he, Kipling, wore only white trousers and a thin vest, he is said to have resembled a Dalmatian dog more than a human being, for he was spotted all over with ink in every direction. Just imagine he's a really prolific writer, just writing all the time and dipping his pen in the ink pot.
The young people listening to this won't actually have had the experience of having a simple pen that you dip into an ink pot. I'm just old enough to have actually done that in the past, in my sort of early school days. And those kind of pens were incredibly messy. And so it's no surprise to me that Kipling would have found himself covered in splotches of ink. Most schoolboys in England were, in fact, in those days.
I can remember the desks with, the little hole there to put the little tub of ink in. I can remember those desks when I was at school. But no, we didn't have the quill and the pot. In the summer of 1883, Kipling visited Shimla, then known as Simla, a well-known hill station and the summer capital for British India. By then, it was the practice for the Viceroy of India and his government to move to Simla for 6 months, and the town became a centre of power as well as pleasure. Kipling's family became annual visitors there, and Lockwood Kipling was asked to serve in Christchurch. Rudyard returned to Simla for his annual leave each year from 1885 to 1888, and the town featured prominently in many of the stories he wrote for the Gazette. My month's leave at Simla, or whatever hill station my people went to, was pure joy. Every golden hour counted. It began in heat and discomfort by rail and road. It ended in the cool evening with a wood fire in one's bedroom, and next morn, 30 more of them ahead. The early cup of tea, the mother who brought it in, and the long talks of us all together again. One had leisure to work, too, at whatever play work was in one's head, and that was usually full. Interesting the way he talks about one's people here, my people. So he understands his group, his ethnic group that he is with, that is an extended part of his family, in contradiction to the natives there. Back in Lahore, 39 of his stories appeared in the Gazette between November 86 and June 87, with Kipling including most of them in Plain Tales from the Hills, his first prose collection, published in Calcutta in January 1888, a month after his 22nd birthday. Kipling's time in Lahore came to an end in November 87, when he was moved to the Gazette's larger sister newspaper, The Pioneer, in Allahabad in the United Provinces, where he worked as assistant editor and lived in Belvedere House from 88 to 89. His writing continued at a frenetic pace, and in 1888 he published six collections of short stories, Soldiers 3, The Story of the Gadsbys, In Black and White, Under the Deodars, The Phantom Rickshaw, and Wee Willie Winkie. These contain a total of 41 stories, with some of them quite long. In addition, as the Pioneer's special correspondent in the western region of Rajputana, he wrote many sketches that were later collected in Letters of Mark and published in From Sea to Sea and Other Sketches, Letters of Travel. He was discharged from the Pioneer in early 1889 after a dispute, but by this time he had increasingly been thinking of his future, and he sold the rights to his sixth volume of stories for £200 and a small royalty, with Plain Tales for £50, and in addition he received 6 months' salary from the Pioneer in lieu of notice. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
Well, just that £200 doesn't sound like a lot by today's standards, but £200 probably would have bought you a house in those days, and so it was quite a considerable amount of money.
Well, he certainly made good use of it. Kipling decided to use the money to move to London, since it was the literary centre of the empire, and on the 9th of March 1889 he left India, travelling first to San Francisco via Rangoon, Singapore, Hong Kong and Japan. He was favourably impressed with Japan, calling its people gracious folk and fair manners. The Nobel Prize Committee cited Kipling's writing on the manners and customs of the Japanese when they awarded his Nobel Prize in Literature in 1907. Kipling later wrote that he had lost his heart to a geisha, whom he called Otoyo, while writing in the United States during the same trip across the Pacific. I had left the innocent East behind, weeping softly for Otoyo. Otoyo was a darling, he said. He then travelled through the United States, writing more articles for the Pioneer that were later to be published in From Sea to Sea and Other Sketches, Letters of Travel. In the course of a long journey across America, he met Mark Twain in Elmira, New York, and was deeply impressed. Kipling arrived unannounced at Twain's home, and later wrote that as he rang the doorbell, it occurred to me for the first time that Mark Twain might possibly have other engagements other than the entertainment of escaped lunatics from India, be they ever so full of admiration. As it was, Twain gladly welcomed Kipling and had a two-hour conversation with him on trends in Anglo-American literature and about what Twain was going to write in a sequel to Tom Sawyer, with Twain assuring Kipling that a sequel was coming, although he had not decided upon the ending yet. Either Sawyer would be elected to Congress or he would be hanged. Twain also passed along the literary advice that an author should get your facts first and then you can distort them as much as you please. Twain, who rather liked Kipling, later wrote of their meeting, "Between us, we cover all knowledge. He covers all that can be known, and I cover the rest." Kipling then crossed the Atlantic to Liverpool in October 1889, soon to make his debut in the London literary world to great acclaim. Shall we get into our greatest Britons then, do you think?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's talk about Rudyard Kipling. Joseph Rudyard Kipling is one of the greatest and most well-known poets and authors that Britain has ever produced. He was born in India, but taken back to England for schooling before military training and then went back to India. His father was upper class and he was groomed for a position in the Anglo-Indian bureaucracy, finding his first job as a journalist working for local newspapers. He was a voracious writer, constantly covered in ink, and where he spoke English but thought in Indian, his style was unique and often dealt with issues of identity and finding one's place in the world. After selling his first books and leaving his job in India, he decided to move to England, as London was the capital of the literary world. And he travelled across Asia and into America first, where he met Mark Twain, before then docking at Liverpool in October 1889. And that's a recap of what we were talking about last week. And one thing I also forgot to mention last week about his actual name, and I always used to think that it was Rudyard Kipling, and it is in actual fact Rudyard Kipling, and Rudyard Kipling comes from the name of the place where his parents met. It was a very romantic place. But the actual name Rudyard comes from the plant rue, which used to apparently grow there. Syrian rue, I think, is the long name of this plant. So Rudyard actually means a yard full of rue. So it is definitely R-U-E is how it is supposed to be spelled. Is there anything that you want to add to that recap, Max?
Well, it's very interesting what you're saying about the pronunciation of Kipling's first name. I think that other names that begin with R-U and D, such as Rudy and Rudolph, they're names that have that R-U, Ru, pronunciation rather than the hard U, because nobody would call somebody who's called Rudolph Rudolph, and nobody would call somebody called Rudy Ruddy. And so it does make sense that Rudyard should be pronounced that way.
It must just have been when I was brought up, I used to call him Rudyard, I guess. So he docked at Liverpool in October 1889. When he got to London, Kipling had several stories accepted by the magazines, and he found a place to live for the next 2 years at Villiers Street near Charing Cross in a building subsequently named Kipling House. And he says, "Meantime, I had found me quarters in Villiers Street, Strand, which 46 years ago was primitive and passionate in its habits and population. My rooms were small, not over clean or well kept, but from my desk I could look out of my window through the fanlight of Gatti's Music Hall entrance across the street, almost onto its stage. The Charing Cross trains rumbled through my dreams on one side, the boom of the Strand on the other, while before my windows, Father Thames, under the shot tower, walked up and down with his traffic." Interesting description there of what London used to be like with the music hall. In the next 2 years, he published a novel, The Light That Failed, had a nervous breakdown, and met an American writer and publishing agent, Walcott Ballastier, with whom he collaborated with on a novel, The Norlaka, a title which he uncharacteristically misspelt, and Norlaka is a place in India. In 1891, as advised by his doctors, Kipling took another sea voyage to South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, and once again to India. He cut short his plans to spend Christmas with his family there when he heard of Ballastier's sudden death from typhoid fever, and decided to return to London immediately. Before his return, he had used a telegram to propose to and be accepted by Walcott's sister, Caroline Starr Ballastier, called Carrie, whom he had met a year earlier and with whom he had apparently been having an intermittent romance. Meanwhile, late in 1891, a collection of his short stories on the British in India, Life's Handicap, was published in London. On 18th of January 1892, Carrie Ballastier and Rudyard Kipling married in London in the thick of an influenza epidemic, when the undertakers had run out of black horses and the dead had to be content with brown ones. And she was 29 years old and he was 26 years old when they got married. And that's quite a late time to get married, I think. Would you say that, Max, at that time?
Yes, I would have thought people would have got, well, certainly women would have been younger than that. Generally, if a woman was above 25 and unmarried in those days, she was in danger of being what they used to call left on the shelf. Men have in those days quite often would marry women that were perhaps 10 years younger than them. And so, from the relationship between their relative ages there, Kipling married slightly younger than would perhaps be the norm, and Carrie married slightly older than would be the norm. It's interesting that they were married in the thick of an influenza epidemic, which is quite sort of a topical aspect of all of this. And again, it just illustrates the way in which there were influenza epidemics that were quite severe, such that they have been remembered in history, and that the COVID-19 pandemic isn't such an unusual thing after all.
Yeah, I also find it interesting that what he really picks up on there is that they were, the undertakers had run out of black horses and they had to be content with brown ones. And I wonder how many horses they actually had at the time. I mean, we're told today we had to have our lockdown to avoid the NHS being overloaded. And back then they were worried that they would run out of black horses for the dead. And you think of the way that funerals are today. I mean, it's almost like a factory line. It's like a process. You're in there for half an hour and you're out and it's a crematorium. And back then it was a proper funeral that you had and the horses had to be right and correct for it. It's just another part of our traditions that have gone by the wayside, I guess. They settled upon a honeymoon that took them first to the United States and then to Japan. But on arriving in Yokohama, they discovered that their bank, the New Oriental Banking Corporation, had failed. Taking this loss in their stride, they returned to the US back to Vermont, Carrie by this time pregnant with their first child, and rented a small cottage on a farm near Brattleboro for $10 a month. According to Kipling, "We furnished it with a simplicity that foreran the hire purchase system. We bought, second or third hand, a huge hot air stove which we installed in the cellar. We cut generous holes in our thin floors for its 8-inch tin pipes. Why we were not burned in our beds each week of the winter, I can never understand. And we were extraordinarily and self-centeredly content." Interesting there, contrast that with today where people would use a hire purchase or buy things on tick or get a loan or what have you, and they've actually lost all their money and they're just going to buy second or third hand stuff. And he must have had an idea of engineering to work it out, put the stove in the cellar and have holes in the floor for the pipes, and obviously as the pipes were going up through the floor they would warm the rooms in the cottage. In this house, which they called Bliss Cottage, their first child, Josephine, was born in 3 foot of snow on the night of the 29th of December, 1892. Her mother's birthday being the 31st and mine the 30th of the same month, we congratulated her on her sense of the fitness of things. So she was born on pretty much almost the same day as Rudyard was. It was also in this cottage that the first dawnings of the Jungle Books came to Kipling. The workroom in the Bliss Cottage was 7 foot by 8, and from December to April, the snow lay level with its windowsill. It chanced that I had written a tale about Indian forestry work, which included a boy who had been brought up by wolves. In the stillness and suspense of the winter of 92, some memory of the Masonic lions of my childhood's magazine and a phrase in Haggard's Nadar the Lily combined with the echo of this tale. After blocking out the main idea in my head, the pen took charge, and I watched it begin to write stories about Mowgli and animals, which later grew into the 2 Jungle Books. With Josephine's arrival, Bliss Cottage was felt to be congested, so eventually the couple bought land, 10 acres worth, on a rocky hillside overlooking the Connecticut River, from Carrie's brother, B.T. Ballastier, and built their own house on it. Kipling named this Norlaka, in honour of Woolcott and their collaboration, and this time the name was spelt correctly. The house still stands on Kipling Road, 3 miles north of Brattleboro in Dummerston, Vermont, a big, secluded, dark green house with shingled roof and sides, which Kipling called his ship, and which brought him sunshine and a mind at ease. His seclusion in Vermont, combined with his healthy, sane, clean life, made Kipling both inventive and prolific. In a mere 4 years, he produced, along with the Jungle Books, a book of short stories, The Day's Work, a novel, Captain's Courageous, and a profusion of poetry, including the volume The Seven Seas. The collection of Barrack Room Ballads was issued in March 1892, first published individually for the most part in 1890, and contained his poems Mandalay and Gunga Din. So he's got quite a nice, idyllic life there in Vermont with snow in the winter, sunshine in the summer. He's got his nice wood stove there and he's writing away, and the idea of the Jungle Book comes to him, probably one of the most famous books.
It does seem a strangely attractive life that you had then.
Definitely, but also you think, well, you know, this is in America and in Vermont, and yet he's thinking about India and the jungle in India. And this boy Mowgli that's being brought up by animals, being brought up by the wolves. I can't really remember reading the Jungle Book. I can remember seeing the Disney movie. I remember I wasn't too keen on Kim. My favourite book was the Just So stories, and I thought that was absolutely fantastic. Did you have a favourite book by Kipling, Max?
Not book. I sound like a bit of a philistine when I tell people this, but I didn't like reading fiction when I was a boy. And in fact, up until I was around about 15 years of age, I could count the number of fiction books I'd actually read on the fingers of one hand and still have fingers to spare. But I used to listen to other people reading me stories. I have listened to the stories, but not read them myself.
Yeah, I was a bit the other way around. I used to love reading fiction and graphic novels. And I think once I got to about 30, I just started reading factual books. All I have now is textbooks and reference books. I don't have any fiction books at all. I'm just fascinated by life and history. Well, Gunga Din, let's have a look at Gunga Din, this poem that he wrote. Gunga Din is a rhyming narrative from the point of view of a British soldier in India. Its titular character is an Indian water carrier, a Bishti, who, after the narrator is wounded in battle, saves his life, only to be shot and killed. In the final three lines, the soldier regrets the abuse that he dealt out to Din and admits that Din is the better man. The poem was published as part of a set of martial poems called the Barrack Room Ballads. In contrast to Kipling's later poem, The White Man's Burden, Gunga Din is named after the Indian and portrays him as a heroic character who is not afraid to face danger on the battlefield as he tends to wounded men. The white soldiers who order Din around and beat him for not bringing the water fast enough are presented as being callous and shallow and ultimately inferior to him. So he's really sort of trying to teach people a lesson here, isn't he? And I think this gives us an idea of the mentality in the British Empire. You had to set a good example. You shouldn't be treating these natives badly. And some of them could be very brave and they could be very honourable. And you just have to, you know, keep an eye out for that and don't imagine that they're always going to be the same. The more I learn about these people from the British Empire, the more they appear to be completely different to the narrative that we have today. And this was in contrast to this other poem that he wrote, The White Man's Burden, which was obviously portraying the white man as you know, the higher of the peoples. And in this one, he's showing that Gunga Din is actually the better man than the British soldier. Do you want to comment on that at all, Max?
Well, just to say that prejudice is something which is frowned on nowadays. But whilst I think that there was a degree of prejudice in the thought processes of people, the people who created the empire, and also the thought processes of those that didn't create the empire. But the point is that I think that prejudging a situation is just where you apply the experience of the past to the present situation in order to, as much as possible, to predict the outcome of the situation in which you find yourself. So I don't think that prejudice is something which should be as badly thought of as it is today. But what the experience of Kipling shows, and some of the other great Britons that we've had, Livingstone again, for example, is that they were people who whilst they may have applied a certain amount of prejudice in prejudging the situations and prejudging the people in whom they came into contact, they were also prepared to modify that prejudice and to recognize worth when the native peoples they came into contact with showed that they were wrong.
I think a lot of the time today, it's actually post-Judas and it gets called pre-Judas. Yeah, and what we're actually talking about is, well, we have looked at these things, we've studied these things, we've looked at the statistics, and we're not talking about stereotypes here, but we're talking about pattern recognition. It's post-Judas, and yet it gets accused of being pre-Judas. It gets accused of being prejudice. We don't actually have that word in the English language, post-Judas, but I think we should have it. It's two words together, so I guess you can use it with a hyphen. Well, the writing life in Norlaco was occasionally interrupted by visitors, including his father, who visited soon after his retirement in 1893, and the British writer Arthur Conan Doyle, who brought his golf clubs, stayed for 2 days, and gave Kipling an extended golf lesson. Kipling seemed to take to golf, occasionally practicing with the local Congregational minister, and even playing with red-painted balls when the ground was covered in snow. However, winter golf was not altogether a success, because there were no limits to a drive. The ball might skid 2 miles down the long slope to the Connecticut River. Kipling loved the outdoors, not the least of whose marvels in Vermont was the turning of the leaves each fall. He described this moment in a letter. "A little maple began it, flaming blood red of a sudden, where he stood against the dark green of a pine belt. Next morning there was an answering signal from the swamp where the sumacs grow. 3 days later the hillsides, as fast as the eye could range, were afire, and the roads paved with crimson and gold. Then a wet wind blew and ruined all the uniforms of that gorgeous army, and the oaks, who had held themselves in reserve, buckled on their dull and bronzed cuirasses, and stood it out stiffly to the last blown leaf, till nothing remained but pencil shadings of bare boughs, and one could see into the most private heart of the woods." That gives us an example of his descriptive powers there. In February 1896, Elsie Kipling was born, the couple's second daughter. But by this time, according to several biographers, their marital relationship was no longer light-hearted and spontaneous. Although they would always remain loyal to each other, they seemed now to have fallen into set roles. In a letter to a friend who had become engaged around this time, the 30-year-old Kipling offered this sombre counsel: "Marriage principally taught the tougher virtues, such as humility, restraint, order, and forethought." So we can see there he's quite a sensible chap. He's looking at what he can learn from life all the time. How can he find some virtue in whatever he's doing, and seeing it as a challenge? The Kiplings loved life in Vermont and might have lived out their lives there were it not for two incidents, one of global politics and the other of family discord. By the early 1890s, the United Kingdom and Venezuela were in a border dispute involving British Guiana. The US had made several offers to arbitrate, but in 1895, the new American Secretary of State, Richard Olney, upped the ante by arguing for the American right to arbitrate on grounds of sovereignty on the continent as an extension of the Monroe Doctrine. This raised hackles in Britain, and the situation grew into a major Anglo-American crisis, with talk of war on both sides. So Britain was really thinking that America was getting too big for its boots at this time, but of course you're actually talking about that side of the world rather than over in Britain. And this Monroe Doctrine was the sort of right to rule, wasn't it? I think, encouraging America to colonize places and set a good example, but because they could, because they had that power, and saying that that power was good and they were going to use it for good. Now, although the crisis eased into greater United States-British cooperation, Kipling was bewildered by what he felt was persistent anti-British sentiment in the United States, especially in the press. He wrote in a letter that it felt like being aimed at with a decanter across a friendly dinner table. By January 1896, he had decided to end his family's good, wholesome life in the United States and seek their fortunes elsewhere. A family dispute became the final straw. For some time, relations between Carrie and her brother, B.T. Ballastier, had been strained owing to his drinking and insolvency. And in May 1896, an inebriated B.T. encountered Kipling on the street and threatened him with physical harm. The incident led to B.T.'s eventual arrest, but in the subsequent hearing and the resulting publicity, Kipling's privacy was destroyed, and he was left feeling miserable and exhausted. In July 1896, a week before the hearing was to resume, the Kiplings packed their belongings, left the United States, and returned to England. I find it interesting here that he's not liking the sort of jingoism that's being expressed against the British, because later on we'll hear of his own jingoism that was being expressed against the Germans. You got any comments you want to make on any of that, Max?
Well, I suppose it was only to be expected to a certain extent that somebody who was as patriotic as Kipling would find that where there were instances where the interests of the United States conflicted with the interests of the United Kingdom or Britain, the British Empire, that he would feel it, that his situation was difficult and perhaps even untenable.
He was actually the poet of the empire, the official poet of the empire. By September 1896, the Kiplings were in Torquay, Devon, on the southwestern coast of England, in a hillside home overlooking the English Channel. Although Kipling did not much care for his new house, whose design, he claimed, left its occupants feeling dispirited and gloomy, he managed to remain productive and socially active. He was by now a famous man, and in the previous 2 or 3 years had increasingly been making political pronouncements in his writings, as well as welcoming his first son John in August 1897. Kipling had begun work on 2 poems, Recessional in 1897 and The White Man's Burden in 1899, which were both to create controversy when published, regarded by some as anthems for the enlightened and duty-bound empire building, capturing the mood of the Victorian era. Others saw irony in the poems and warnings of the perils of empire. And we've got a quote from The White Man's Burden here. "Take up the white man's burden, send forth the best ye breed. Go bind your sons to exile, to serve your captives' need. To wait in heavy harness on fluttered folk and wild, your new caught sullen peoples, half devil and half child." Now, I think we can see there that he's seeing both sides of it, isn't he? He's saying it's the very best of the white men that go out on these colonizing expeditions, and while the natives are in some sense a captive, it is the white people that are actually serving the natives' needs. It's the white man that is doing all that he can to help these people. And we can see here with this last line here where he says half devil and half child, you know, children are innocent and they require looking after and they require helping out. And that was the way that black people were seen, especially the slaves. They were seen as being innocents and being like children. And that even played into the racial science of the day, where they would say that black people don't have beards because they're an immature race. The white race has a beard because he's a mature race. And what we have here is a younger race. So they did look on them as innocent. But at the same time, because of the ultra violence and the sexuality that they saw, the orgies, the cannibalism, all these other depraved things that they saw amongst these natives, that he also sees them as half devil. So I think he's very thoughtful about this and understands the difference between the races and the burden, basically, that there is of being a white man, is that you have to show virtue. You have to be the very best of the best because you can do that. And these other races may not be capable of that. And we have to set them a good example. You got any thoughts on the white man's burden, Max?
Well, there was a study done some time ago by an author called Corelli Barnett, who wrote a book about the British Empire. I can't remember what the exact title was off the top of my head, but in that book, he effectively outlines that maintaining and administering the British Empire cost Britain as much as Britain made out of the empire. And so, you know, a lot of people nowadays, particularly those who are representing ethnic minorities or who are of a left-wing disposition, they like to claim that the British Empire sucked the wealth out of the empire. But Corelli Barnett would argue that that's not the case. And certainly the poetry of Kipling here would tend to indicate that he felt the same way, that the empire was as much an obligation placed upon the shoulders of white men as it was something which brought us booty or wealth.
And also brought wealth to the natives. And as we talked about in the David Livingstone one, it was the colonizing of Africa that actually put a stop to Africans selling other Africans as slaves. There is also foreboding in the poems and a sense that all could yet come to naught. And this is a quote from Recessional. Far cold our navies melt away, on dune and headland sinks the fire. Lo, all our pomp of yesterday is one with Nineveh and Tyre. Judge of the nations, spare us yet, lest we forget, lest we forget. And what he's talking about there is that empires always fall. And we have that throughout history. We have all these empires that fall, and nobody really knew why this happened. I go along with the theory that it's actually race mixing that brings about the end of these empires. But nobody has really, apart from that, has actually come up for a reason why these empires rise and they fall. But he was obviously looking back in history and thinking, well, eventually this British Empire is going to go. So he was praying that the British Empire was not going to go the same way as Nineveh and Tyre. And he's praying to the judge of the nations to spare Britain, basically. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
I'm just ready to say that for any administration to last indefinitely, or for any empire to last indefinitely, it needs to go through a process of constant renewal. And I think that one of the failings that most empires fall victim to at some time or another during their history is that they become too tradition bound to the point where they don't renew sufficiently in order to for the empire builders to retain their vigor. What happens is that the empire builders eventually become corrupted in the process of trying to keep everything the same and trying to live entirely by tradition, and that is the main cause of the collapse of empires, in my view.
The cycle, what is it? Hard times create good men. Good men create soft times. Soft times create weak men. Weak men create hard times. And on it goes. In The White Man's Burden, Kipling encouraged American colonization and annexation of the Philippine Islands, a Pacific Ocean archipelago conquered in the three-month Spanish-American War of 1898. As a poet of imperialism, Kipling exhorts the American reader and listener to take up the enterprise of empire, yet warns about the personal costs faced, endured, and paid in building an empire. Nonetheless, American imperialists understood the phrase, the white man's burden, to justify imperial conquest as a mission of civilization that is ideologically related to the continental expansion philosophy of manifest destiny of the early 19th century. And that manifest destiny is what I was referring to earlier, tying in with the Monroe Doctrine, that there is this burden upon us that we have to share the civilization. We have to bring this civilization to these other races. Whether that is the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do, it is based upon a desire to be charitable, to be good, to be virtuous, to help those out who are less well off than you. It comes from a very noble feeling that we have as white men, which I don't see in these other races. These other races don't have that, and at the same time, they don't actually have that gift of being able to create civilization. And I guess it's fair enough of us to share the gifts of civilization with these other races, but we shouldn't actually share our civilization with them, if you see what I mean. We could share the medicines and the rest of it, but they should be staying in their own countries. Once we allow them to come into our countries, to come into our civilization, then that weakens our civilization, and eventually it could weaken it so much that there is no more civilization left, because the original people that built civilization, their genetics are no longer intact because they've become blended with the genetics of people that never actually built their own original civilization. And then that civilization is going to fall apart. And I think that was really the mistake that was made. Instead of actually keeping to segregation, instead of keeping the races apart, we told them all that they were all equal And it was nasty and mean to say that people shouldn't mix together, whereas not mixing together is just it's a natural instinct. And if it wasn't a natural instinct, then we wouldn't have the separate races that we do. The very fact that we do have different races shows that it is a natural instinct to keep the races apart, and an unnatural one to mix them together. It's like a fetish. And of course, it's promoted all the time on the television, in the adverts and on the television programs, as a way to weaken us and as a way to strengthen our competitors. And obviously that's the way that I see it. Max, have you got any final thoughts on Rudyard Kipling that you'd like to say?
Well, just in terms of what I was saying a bit earlier on about the sort of renewal of the idea of empire, it is a natural thing for countries to want to extend their sphere of influence. And in extending their sphere of influence, if the other countries that they come into contact with have not achieved a sufficient level of civilization to actually be of use, or to be of the best use, then there is the inclination there to conquer those people and to uplift the level of civilization that you find there. In terms of renewal, you can, in my view, that there's an indication when an empire has reached its limits, and it's the point at which people are no longer prepared to fight for the empire and to expand the empire, become embarrassed by the need to impose our influence sometimes on people in situations where we know what's best, and it's ultimately going to be in their interest for them to benefit from the technology and the civilization that we can bring to them. And if you look back through, there's a very famous hymn, which is "I Vow to Thee, My Country." And if we have a look at that particular hymn, I can't remember the name, I think it's Sir Cecil Spring Rice was the person who wrote the words, but he wrote three verses. And yet, if you look for the lyrics of that particular hymn, you'll find that there are almost everywhere only two verses that are reported. And if you manage to find the third verse is actually the second verse. So there are three verses, but the second verse is always missed out. And the second verse kind of fits very neatly with the kind of thoughts that Kipling probably would have had, and that the patriotism that he would have felt towards the British Empire. And the third verse rings, "I heard my country calling away across the sea, across the wastes of waters she calls and calls to me. Her sword is girded at her side, her helmet on her head, and around her feet are lying the dying and the dead. I hear the noise of battle, the thunder of her guns. I haste to thee, my mother, a son among thy sons." And that's the kind of patriotism that's that Kipling would have felt, and obviously that's the author, Spring Rice, felt at the time, and something which was sufficient, that kind of patriotism, to sustain the empire. But when people felt that embarrassed to sing those words, then that begins the process of crumbling and the loss of renewal, and that brings about then the loss of empire.
I think you got a good point there. When people are no longer prepared to die for it, and also it's our duty to do this, because if it's not us that are imposing law and order and all the traits of civilization, then who is going to do it? Somebody else is going to do it, and their idea of law and order may be very different to ours. You know, it's just so basic what should be going on. And instead of that, we've just allowed this crazy, unnatural idea of equality to take over. Well, we will leave that there for today, I think, and we will continue on Monday with more of our greatest Britons. Thank you very much for listening.